This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is James Cartwright, who currently serves as the inaugural holder of the Harold Brown Chair in Defense Policy Studies for the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he is a senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard Kennedy School. A retired United States Marine Corps four-star general, he served as the 8th Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he previously served as the commander of the U.S. Strategic Command. General Cartwright, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
Rockford, Illinois, up in the very northern part of Illinois Central, about 90 miles west of Chicago.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, I'm sure I got in trouble a couple of times, and that shaped it, but... most of my memories as a young kid were being free labor on my grandfather's farm. Mm-hmm. And so summers and weekends were spent doing that kind of work, which early on in life instills in you a sense of discipline about having to do something on a prescribed time, in a prescribed way, and hard work, and an enjoyment of the outdoors and things like that. All of those were elements that I got to experience in early life.
And what in your education led you to the military, or was it just circumstances?
As always, a lot of it is circumstance. My father was a Marine, just a young enlisted Marine for 2 years, so that was kind of my introduction to the Marine Corps. But I can remember hanging around airports, watching airplanes fly in my young days and being interested in that. Not that I thought it was going to amount to anything, but it was just interesting because near the farm was an airport. And so, in the long run, when I went off to college, there was this conflict going on, the Vietnam War. And so I was drafted. So that wasn't of my own choosing. And so when I left college, you had the choice of what service and kind of the character of service, and I elected to go as an officer in aviation in the Marine Corps. And that kind of started me down a path that I hadn't planned on, and then I continued.
Mm-hmm. And you never looked back. And was it the flying, that first trajectory as moving to the cockpit that really drew you in?
It was the flying for sure. I absolutely fell in love with it. It was a very athletic activity, and I had been, in athletics, all the way through school. But there was a technology side to it, a science side to it, a human dynamic, and it was just putting all the pieces together that I liked so much, and I certainly fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm. And technology, was that something you acquired on the farm? No, the affection for it.
A little bit on the farm, in that, the construct, at least in the age that I went through, we were in the transition from early tractors and steam into the gas and diesel tractors and whatnot. And I can remember going from kind of the measure of merit was you had one bottom, they called it one blade plows, and by the time I left, there were four blade plows. That was progress. That was technology. So there was an interest there, an interest that got fostered in college. In a big way, just the opportunity to work around labs and science issues. And then when I got into the military, it just all seemed to fit together with personality and athletics, and all of the pieces came together.
Mm-hmm. Now you've held some important command positions in the military throughout your career, and I want to trace the cursus honorum, we used to call it, the career path that led you up the military ladder. But let me ask you, I'm always interested in kind of the skills and the temperament, you know, involved in various kinds of roles. So let's talk about your role as a commander. What do you see as really critical as the elements of leadership that you've learned?
Well, one is an understanding of what it is you're trying to accomplish and putting that at the front end, which oftentimes gets forgotten. Second is an understanding of how to work with people and to get them to understand what the objective is, mm-hmm. and to get them to measure the value of their contribution by the contribution to that objective. And then the other is just plain understanding and not losing patience, because people are people and things happen. And I take that back to my life on the farm. I mean, so you just didn't get to pick the weather. Sometimes it was good and sometimes it was bad. Sometimes the crop was good and sometimes it was bad. And being mad at it really didn't solve anything. And so a lot of those types of temperament issues contribute to a climate in a command that is conducive to people having a sense of autonomy, but really more importantly, a sense of contribution. And if they can feel like at every level they're contributing in some way that's meaningful, then they're willing to be tolerant of the things that are irritants that will always occur in any situation, whether it's people irritants or didn't have the right spare parts or whatever it was. But if they feel like they're contributing, they can work through those things. And that, to me, is really critical.
Mm-hmm. Now, as commander of the Strategic Command, you were given a set of complex tasks by Secretary Rumsfeld. Let's talk a little about that and the skills you had to bring to bear. What was the mission, so to speak, that you were given, and then what was involved in implementing it? And then the third part, how had your different roles previously prepared you for that?
The U.S. Strategic Command is the command in the United States that has our strategic weapons. Usually that's a moniker for nuclear weapons, and the delivery systems for them, and responsible for strategies, employment, maintenance, training, all of the issues associated with that. And this is a storied command. It's been around for a long time, since the 50s, and has had a key role, particularly in the Cold War, towards our defense. The intent with Secretary Rumsfeld was to add new missions into this organization that were similar in scope. In other words, they had global implications, were going to be deployed and maintained on a global scale rather than on a local scale. And so we added in the mission for space, shut down what at that time had been called Space Command. That was brought into the command. So I inherited all of the responsibilities of space. A new technology called cyber that was an outgrow of the information revolution in this country was added into the command. Responsibility for military surveillance, intelligence type activities, and a responsibility for a new capability that was just being introduced called missile defense that had been introduced in the Reagan era, had not quite taken off, and now was coming back because of necessity of the proliferation of ballistic missiles around the world. And so those capabilities, none of them other than space were already commands. They were organizations that had to be made into military commands, were all added in to this command that heretofore had been there strictly for nuclear weapons. There were no people that came with those activities, so I had people that had to learn new skills. We had to bring in new people and trade old away. And so it was a very culturally disruptive activity in the organization. When you look at something like that, large organization change is always a challenge. And it's not the technology, it's not the mission. It is getting people to understand that we're going to have to do things differently. And for them to understand that when we do it differently, there will be a contribution for them. But seeing that contribution early on is often difficult, particularly in the, you know, in the worker level, let's say, and the middle management level of the command. And so trying to bring the whole organization along with these new missions, assimilating all these responsibilities, new skills that didn't exist before. Some of these missions had no military counterpart to them. In other words, cyber, as an example, really didn't have any place I could go, oh, I'll go to such and such a place and get all the cyber people. There wasn't a place to go get that. Same with missile defense. And so it took a lot of work to bring these disparate skills in, train people up, and bring together a coherent type of capability for the nation. For me as an individual, prior to that, and thinking my way through, okay, how, where am I going to find the skills to do this? Leadership is something that you learn early in the military, and it is a constant activity that you practice and work. And so that, that skill was there. The technical side and understanding how to think about problems across these broad array of missions was something that the joint world, my time in Washington, my time in significant R&D studies, working on building and deploying the FNA-18 and the R&D that was necessary for that and how you develop technologies, work on different kinds of weapons studies and building and developing and deploying new weapons. All were contributors. And then kind of the final piece was understanding organizational constructs, organizational incentive structures that help people move in the right direction, understanding budgeting and where resources go and how you acquire those resources to ensure that you can, in fact, be successful. Those were all key issues that were necessary. And then because I had spent time in Washington, I had an outward look from the command that probably was very beneficial in being able to work with the Congress and with the administration and with the DOD to be able to pull the pieces of these missions together, create organizational constructs that would in fact fit in to the authorities that the services had for resourcing and training, would fit into the deployment responsibilities of the joint side of the equation, would fit into the yearly programming for resources with the Congress and committees of jurisdiction. All of those pieces were critical in putting together a plan that answered all of the outward customers and internal customers or people that had to be able to help or provide service or whatever was necessary in order to make these things actually come to life.
And what was the big frustration in the biggest frustration in trying to accomplish this? I mean, and then as a result of that frustration, did you learn something new that you hadn't known?
I think culture is the biggest part. I mean, people have to understand that before they let go of one trapeze, that there's something there that's going to be meaningful. We'll employ them. We'll pay them. We'll provide home and shelter for family, et cetera, food. But the idea, particularly for middle management, to understand what that role is going to be, they got to middle management by being a specialist in some area. If that specialty goes away, what's their ability to then continue to manage? And they know what they know, and they can't yet see what the possibility is going to be. And so they may move in a direction that looks positive, but what I learned in this evolution was it ran on about 6-month cycles. I'd see progress for 6 months, and then we'd start to retrench. We'd start to go back to old ways, and you'd have to put in a little more incentive in and push harder, and then we'd get another 6 months. But that cycle went on for a good 2 years of before the command really started to say, okay, this isn't going to go away. It's not just a flash in the pan. These technologies and capabilities are real. I can learn. I can contribute. And now I've got to do what I have to do here to make sure that, one, I'm contributing, and two, I've got a livelihood in front of me, particularly for the civilian side of the organization, that I can continue to work in.
And in your role, the skills that you have developed in budgeting, in understanding the elements of weapons acquisition, in understanding what the future technology environment might look like, all of those were inputs in to your ability to lead this.
Yeah, early in the in my career, when I transitioned out of the cockpit, and they no longer would let me have fun flying, I did a tour working R&D and with labs, particularly national labs and service labs, in developing capabilities to put into what was really one of our very first digital airplanes, the FNA-18, and add computational power to it, things like that we just really hadn't done before with airplanes. So that was very valuable, learning how to do that, not only what technologies are likely to mature and move in a way, which ones actually fit the mission and aren't just really neat, which ones can you afford and bring to market in time, do they fit into the R&D schedules that you can get the resource to support them. Understanding and learning all of that was very important. The next time I went to Washington, I did a study, or I was the lead of a study that was called the Deep Attack Weapons Mix Study. And this was a look at all weapons that we were buying in the Department of Defense and trying to understand which of those needed to be set aside, which of them required modernization, what modernization was available, et cetera. And this was in the era of the initial deployment of global positioning satellites. So GPS became a key part in transitioning from weapons that just fell to the earth where you know, where they may, so to speak, to very precise weapons. And it was that transition after the first Gulf War of moving away from the pure gravity weapon to weapons that had guidance systems that would put them where you really wanted them, and made us substantially more efficient, not only in airplanes, but in artillery and naval fires, et cetera. So it was a big study. It was a very important study. And I learned a lot about how to think about what actually is ready for development, what is a nice idea but is not going to be ready, and what matches up with what we believe the realistic threat profiles will be for the next, say, 20 to 30 years. Most of these decisions turn out to be decisions that you're making a little bit in the blind, and you're trying to look into the future, and nobody's crystal ball is perfect. But you want to find something that the likelihood of needing a capability like a gravity bomb or a laser-guided bomb or something like that is going to be out there most any time. If we're going to have any kind of conflict, it's going to be useful. And so what do these weapons look like? And we basically fielded what is today the suite of weapons that we have used for the last 20 years.
So in a way, if we were trying to make a distinction between theory and practice, it sounds like the best training is heavily weighed through experience, different kinds of experiences.
Right, I think that's right. I doesn't make it right, but I tended to take on new challenges like the command or a new weapon system and whatnot, with a reasonable understanding of what it takes just to field a system. And then as I confronted challenges, whether they were cultural or technical, I gained an understanding of how to go find people who had an experience similar. Some reading, but I found it was practical experience from someone, a mentor, was far more efficient and effective in moving whatever problem I had down the road, solving it, finding a way to overcome an obstacle of some sort. So I tend to lean towards the mentor, the subject matter expert. I'll play at least three or four different opinions about the same problem off against each other, because they're never for your situation. They solve the problem for a different situation, and you're trying to see what fits here and what are the dynamics in the organization that you're working with that would make a tool more preferable than another.
In the role you described as a commander of the Strategic Command, it seems like that there were two missions in a way, sometimes dismantling. Taking apart things, possibly eliminating programs on the one hand, but on the other hand, building new entities, building new programs. Compare the difficulties there of the two.
Yeah, it was a rich understanding and a rich experience from the standpoint that you shouldn't be just tinkering with the nation's security. So what I would refer to as strategic stability. As you're bringing a new capability on, it's disruptive. How much and when do you divest of something, either in total or in partial, as this new capability comes on? There's an audience internal that is technical in nature. In other words, does it work? And then there's an external audience, which is all of your adversaries that are watching this, trying to decide what are the implications for them if this is successful. So missile defense being kind of a key activity there. As other nations have watched what we have done, I mean, this was a program that everybody said could not work. The concept of hitting a bullet with a bullet was something that people said just couldn't work. Well, technically, when you looked at it, it can work. And so the question was, did you misread? Was the technical wrong? Is there something you didn't understand? You have a huge body, both politically and adversarially, that are looking at this and saying, don't go forward. This is a lot of money. At the same time, you're maintaining a legacy arsenal of weapons that you kind of question their utility. You know, are they going to be useful as you move into the next generation threat and the environment that develops in the world? And so playing that balance, playing the understanding of risk, internal technical risk of will one work before you let one go away, playing the more political and diplomatic side of the equation of, okay, you're introducing disruptive technologies. They may not have an answer on the other side for that disruptive technology. That could put them in a less stable condition. It may actually destabilize the world more than it stabilizes it, even though your intent is to eventually stabilize. How do you manage that strategic stability with your adversaries, with your friends, with your disbelievers? It was a huge learning experience for me. I loved it. I mean, I just loved it. But I got so much help from so many people.
Now, explain to us what your next role was, that is, Deputy Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What is that role about? It's not command.
It's not a command. No, it was built or it was formulated and stood up under Goldwater Nichols. And initially it was to, the idea was to give the chairman a counterpart so that when the chairman traveled or was incapacitated or whatever, you had somebody else that was there running, almost a COO, running the organization, making sure the trains ran on time, day in and day out, and then could step in at any time for the role that the chairman would play. And it stayed in that kind of framework for the early years. As the dialogue over the last 10 years has developed about soft power and whole of government and the integration of all of the elements of power associated with the nation state, the role of the vice chairman became more and more external but internal to the country. In other words, my external role with the Congress and with the administration to make sure that, one, they understood what we could and couldn't do, alternative strategies for problem solutions that emerge, the ability to describe for the Congress and for the administration what we needed to be doing in the future and to be able to, in a hockey analogy, to skate to where the puck was going to be. You know, trying to do that and making sure that they understood that certain investments really needed to be made if you wanted to be in a position where the black swan appeared and you didn't have an answer. You just don't ever want to get there. Doesn't mean you solve the problem, but the likelihood is greatly diminished if you can think about the problem that way. And so the vice chairman has become more and more involved over the past 10 to 15 years with the activities associated with the Congress and the administration day in and day out, trying to coordinate with other members of the cabinet, other cabinet agencies, particularly state and the intelligence side of the equation, the capabilities necessary for national security.
Mm-hmm. And in this role, you become something of a strategist and a planner, right? Is that fair? Yeah.
It's true. I had several tours on the joint side that were associated with strategy, with gaming, with analytics associated with military operations, a lot of analytic work. And so that gave me a basis for understanding in general terms how to look at an adversary or a problem or a challenge, how to take what is being done diplomatically and try to find military supportive activities that would help that diplomacy be realized. And if that diplomacy stalled or failed, would be available to be used to reset so to speak, the diplomacy capabilities and put it back in the hands of the diplomacy side after the whatever conflict, whether it was a dust-up or whatever, occurred. And it's so important to understand that. What was the objective when you started? Does the military capability that you employ fit that objective? And does it fit the end state of return to diplomacy that will leave you in a better place? Okay. Almost any strategy works for just going out and destroying things. What you want to make sure you're doing is, what is the end state you're trying to get to? Why haven't you gotten there? What would make you have the opportunity to reset the diplomacy and let it pick up again, only have that diplomacy be more meaningful and more effective?
So it sounds like, in addition to the real adversary out in the real world, another adversary here is inertia. That is, the inertia of old programs that need to pass, but also the inertia that comes when you start a new program, which is linked to a toolbox, for example, diplomacy, but which can be perceived and implemented in a way that it becomes an end in itself.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Institutions, large institutions, resist change. And so when you introduce new tools, whether those tools are a realization that the world is moving in a different direction and you need to get out in front of it, or more likely in the last 10 years, when the adversary introduces something on the battlefield and you have to react and you have to get ahead of that problem, making sure that you can do it and do it quickly. The second here of reacting to the battlefield, institutional bias there is usually much less and much easier to deal with. It's when you're trying to skate to where the hockey puck is going to be, so to speak, that you run into more institutional bias, cultural bias, that doesn't like to let go of what it is they're doing for good reason. And we see this today in large measure in our nuclear stockpile. I mean, what is the future going to bring? What's the likelihood that the remnants of mutual assured destruction need to be retained? What elements of that need to be retained, and for what? And what is it you're going to use it for? And therefore, how big, how many, in what ilg, what delivery system? All of those questions come into play in the abstract, because it hasn't happened. And what has happened is we've been very successful in the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the institution wants to just keep doing that. And the reality is, things like terrorism, things like the proliferation of intellectual capital through computers and whatnot, multimedia and social media, are out there. And the world is changing. Mm-hmm. And the likelihood that the threat of mutual assured destruction to, say, a terrorist organization is credible has significantly diminished. And so we've got to start to understand how we're going to think about the threats of the future in a very multipolar world, not a bipolar with two superpowers.
If you take the Global Zero agenda, what are the points of leverage for making this change possible? Is it as an insider making the argument in the Pentagon, or is, as we see now, former national security advisors and former defense and state officials on the outside trying to lobby the system, interestingly enough, which they helped create in a way? Yeah.
I think it'll be interesting to watch this transition occur, because I think you've said it right in that it is not likely the institution of United States Strategic Command is going to lead that change. It is more likely that we need to sit down and understand what the national security strategy is going to look like for the future. It was not an election year issue, so you have to now bring it forward. I think we all made conscious decisions that we would do a little bit of work at that point, but the real implementer, if there is to be an implementer for change, is going to be the president. It has to be. And he's going to have to work with his counterparts around the world to move this activity forward. Now, this activity is not getting to zero. That's not the issue. It's zero is like saying I want peace, not war. But it is a venue by which you can measure progress. So what is it you need these weapons for? what's the likelihood that you're going to have to employ them, and if so, in what way? So what's an appropriate delivery system? How many would it take for you to feel safe? And then this issue of strategic balance again. If we have a successful capability like missile defense or cyber, what are the things that will address that we heretofore have used nuclear weapons for? And so you saw in the most recent START negotiations, treaty negotiations, that in the preamble, they addressed for the first time missile defense and what was called prompt global strike, which is strategic weapons that are conventional in nature. In other words, they're not nuclear. Because the realization is there are other tools in the toolkit, and they're appropriate tools, and they make sense, and they give an administration or a government more options to avoid getting to the precipice of nuclear war. And that's what you want. You want as many tools from influence and statesmanship through your conventional forces and your strategic forces, more options to keep you from getting to what we would call kind of the weapons of last resort, which in most cases are nuclear.
And so this in your background, the work with new technologies in a way has sensitized you to the array of possibilities the technology puts on the table, so to speak, as you are saying, well, these old programs need to go for such and such a reason.
Right. I think that's true, but I always try to understand. I mean, there's all sorts of things you can invent out there.
Yeah.
What is it we're going to need? What's the strategy look like? And so the dialogue that's going on associated with Global Zero and other organizations is a dialogue of what is it we're going to need to be able to do? Mm-hmm. And then you start to put into that capability the kinds of things that missile defense has brought us, that cyber could bring us, prompt global strike, et cetera. And those basically came out of ideas in the Reagan era and have been carried through in one way or another. And now, given some of those, I've certainly had an opportunity to play in some of those areas and to develop not just missile defense for missile defense, but missile defense that had a specific niche and a specific role in the world that was really, to a large extent, hard to dispute. We needed to stop the proliferation of ballistic missiles. Didn't matter what was on top of them, but their ability to come in cheaply and reach out and touch people in just minutes or seconds had no counterpart. And to build another offensive counterpart or to go immediately to nuclear weapons was completely inappropriate. You needed some capability. And so it's understanding what you need and driving the technologies in that direction rather than, oh, it looks like I could go invent this. Now let me invent a strategy that matches it.
Mm-hmm. So that in a way technology can be a vehicle for this transition from hard power to soft power.
It can. And it will be. It has to be. But in doing that, you have to fill up the soft power toolbox, so to speak, with things that are credible that an adversary would, in fact, look at and say, okay, maybe there's a different way of doing what I wanted to do, and maybe we can find common ground here.
Let's talk a little about the drone technology, because this is an example of a technology that really came out of the cruise missiles, right? Was there some connection there? And so help us understand the thought processes involved in deploying that, and then the difficulties of controlling its use, maybe.
Well, there's a long history of unmanned vehicles, whether they be cruise or missiles and rockets and things like that. But what came to light in the trend of conflict over the last 15 years has been that, one, it's become very precise. Two, it's almost 24 hours a day. You need to know what's going on out there, and you need to be able to protect your forces. And as the mobility of ground forces has increased, the requirement to put in front of them the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets and the weapons assets to keep them protected as they maneuver and get surprised or whatever happens on the ground. You don't want them going out from under that umbrella. And we had started to get out beyond where that umbrella could actually operate. And so what we were looking for was if I, as a Marine, you're always a rifleman first. Well, do I want to call for somebody if I get in trouble and then hope they get there if they get there maybe in 20 or 30 minutes, then stay around for 20 or 30 minutes. That might solve a local problem, but it doesn't give you a warm sense, and they're not telling you what's around the next corner, et cetera. You're responding to being attacked. How do you change that problem? How do you do it in a way that's affordable, and how do you keep something on the battlefield longer than a human being can be functional out there? And that was the issue, particularly with aviation. How do you get something to be out there for 24 hours a day? A man in the cockpit's about 9 hours of useful life. And so when we looked at some of the smaller, medium-sized unmanned aerial vehicles, it became clear, one, they operate for 20, 24 hours. Two, you can weaponize them. You can put sensors on them. So they can be the eyes and ears. They can be the weapon protection of somebody, and they're there 24 hours a day. So that allows me to go out further, stay out there longer, and before I have to come back and rearm or come back and get back under the umbrella of my forces. And the cost factor was so different than putting a sophisticated fighter out there that could do four other missions, true. But these assets were very, very reliable, stayed there for a long time. So it's a guy on the ground. If you ask me which one I wanted the guy who was going to be there 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to know. And if you ask me, you know, do I want to have somebody in the cockpit just kind of tell me what's going on out there, or do I want to actually say, that hill, I want to know what's on the other side of that hill. I want something to go look at it and come back and tell me what's going on over there. I don't want to be surprised on my flanks.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the context of military considerations, those explanations help us understand why we go for the program. But the question then becomes, how do we? Wasn't it Rumsfeld's line? Are we creating more terrorists, you know, than we're killing? What I want to get at is, how do you, once you adopt a program like that, where should we look in the system? And maybe it's outside the Pentagon to impose the values that say, hey, this has limited use, but we want to pull back from a use that in essence undermines our values or undermines our goals in a particular area.
I think it's true with any new technology, whether it be a weapon or a delivery platform, that you develop it for what seem to be very right reasons at the time, and you use it that way. But as it matures, you find that it can do other things. A drone can look for long periods of time at a group of people, see their activities, and say, that's clearly somebody who's doing something wrong. And it has weapons that are very precise and can go down and basically not be like 50, 500-pound bombs, but be like a single round into the area. Those are all very good qualities. The larger question now is that as the threat has matured in the world, threats of terrorists and their lethality and their ability to basically intermix into populations and go to areas that are ungoverned, etc. How do we handle that threat? This tool has been used many times to handle that threat. Is that an appropriate use? It's not about the tool. The tool gave us the capability to, for sure. But we have to understand the moral implications of the activities. That discussion, number one, should not be the result is we get rid of all drones. The issue here is we are not going to do the following things, or we are going to condone the following things, but only under the following circumstances. Those debates, I find, are quite rich. Those debates are not, you know, just stuffed off in a corner and people are told to go away and don't talk about this. These are very rich debates, and I think the richness in those debates has been the result of discussions about whole of government activities and working between agencies and having perspectives for the administration brought up. How does Justice see this? How does the State Department see this, et cetera? Thinking your way through the implications, second and third order effects, that could arise from something that was brought into being for a very good reason. Okay. And I think those debates, you have to have them. What you don't want to have happen is have people somehow believe that they can't talk about those problems. Mm-hmm. They can't bring them up. They can't talk because it's just such a good deal. It's solving a problem for us. We're not going to even think about the bad side. You have to.
And how important is the public discourse on this? Is that an added element that's
important?
It is.
It is very much so. As you listen to the discourse, people generally have a good sense of the threat to them. Okay, they may not have it perfect, but clearly something like 9/11 was a very compelling activity. How much and how long and to what extent are you going to do something different to get after a very different threat that your old tools just didn't work for? And when is it too much and it needs to be reined in? And this, you know, this democracy is very good at those debates. Oftentimes we get too far down the road. We may have an accident or something that catalyzes the debate and crystallizes what were you talking about. But the debate is good, and it is something that we should embrace, not avoid.
In your writings and your speeches that I've followed, you as a strategist and a global thinker are very sensitive to the complex cultural, social, and political trends in the world that make military power really not a solution. And I'm curious as to how we get away from and I believe that the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs emphasized, as did the former Secretary of Defense, that too many resources were being put into the military and in comparison to, say, state, right, diplomacy, development aid, and so on.
Yeah. I think it's important to understand, that just like any disease, a little prophylactic at the beginning is a lot more efficient than waiting until it metastasizes or something along those lines. And so, I really think there is something in a discussion that we ought to have more of in this country, which is, should we have a budget for defense or should we have a budget for national security that State Department and USAID and Justice, et cetera, all share in as security for the country, and that in times of peace that the resources move more and migrate more to the prevention side of the equation. And then when necessary, they're there for the, okay, I've got to do something about this that's more kinetic in nature. But to have what people call stovepipes or silos of excellence where the money goes in here and you got to use it and you got to spend it and it can only be spent on this, and you can't adjust to the fact that, okay, I'm not really in conflict, but something's developing over here and I really need to do some preventative work over here, and I don't have the resources. I don't have the skills to hire people that are appropriate culturally for the activity that needs to occur.
It's interesting that when you think about Iraq and some of the accounts of that war, the extent to which there was so much idealism, at play among the civilians, on the ground there, and also, among the military. But it was as if those efforts could not realize their potential because of the lack of understanding of the broader strategic issues in that country.
Yeah. Nation building is often the result of mission creep. Not necessarily in this case, but often not. So in other words, you went there for one reason and now you feel somehow that you have a moral obligation to actually make these people, rich or bring them up to a standard of living that somebody has artificially set. And that mindset, number one, it's hugely cost imposing on us. Number two, we often want to make them like us, and that's not what they want to be. And so you have completely disconnected objectives and resource allocation, and you can't reconcile it, so you just keep trying harder with more money, more people, more lives, etc. And at some point, you have to come to reconcile that. And not understanding that going in or losing sight of what you understood when you started something can lead you down a path where you end up with an objective that's just not realizable.
Mm-hmm. And the military, in a way, because it's garnered so many resources, it becomes the default position for people who don't know what they want to do or should do.
Right. And so that's just not really not the right way to look at it. You use diplomacy to prevent conflict. When the diplomatic tools run out or become ineffective because the adversary has basically immunized themselves against them, you may need to go to some level of kinetic activity to make those tools useful again, but it's with the idea that you want to get back to those tools as quickly as possible so that you can get a diplomatic solution to the problem. And if the military encroaches in either direction on that activity, you begin to get mission creep. And that sometimes that happens because they're the only ones that are available or the only ones that are resourced or things like that. And you put the wrong face on what you want the objective to be. I mean, that's what could happen.
Looking at your career and the different roles you've played and what you've learned, and in a way you've been a kind of an integrator of technology, addressed to particular challenges in new environments, and you've dealt with the bureaucracies that want to hold on to the old and not move to the new to fight the last war and not the next one. So how do you view this era of austerity that we're now in? In other words, in what ways can that be an opportunity to essentially move in the right direction, deploying the kinds of skills you've described in your own career?
Yeah. I'm a little bit outspoken on this, so you can take it with that caution. But to me, this is a huge opportunity. We, as a nation, when we fight, we throw everything in. We give everybody everything that we can possibly give them to be successful, and that's a great attribute. When we come out of those conflicts, then we start to tear down some of that spending, reduce it, bring us back in line with more peacetime activities. And what happens is that historically we have things like hollowing the force, which is the constant reduction of incrementally of budgets, and therefore I take a little from every program and every capability, and all of a sudden the capabilities are really not real anymore. There's not enough people to make a division or whatever the challenge is. So to me, one of the things that we want to do is figure out how much we need to come down and get it right up front and go ahead and use the shock of that to bring it down and to change behavior, to say, I can't afford to be on a profile that only builds me one ship per coast or one airplane per coast. I've got to be on a profile that gets me back to scale. I have to build airplanes that are cheaper but effective, that I can proliferate out and actually deploy all over the world, or ships or whatever it is. And I think the ship one was the only one that made it into the debates. But this idea that we've got to get back to scale, but we've got to do it smartly. We've got to mix technologies that are leveraging, that allow us to do the things we are most likely going to have to do in the future for a price that is much more in line with what our resources are, and to force that technology into it. It doesn't mean that we're going to not need people. It doesn't mean that there's not going to be soldiers or armies. What it does mean is that, and you look at the kind of the history of warfare, just go back to the World Wars, we fought as armies in World War I and World War II. We fought as divisions in Korea and Vietnam. We're fighting as brigades now. They're more lethal, they're more mobile with less people, and technology has allowed them to be more effective over a much broader range. That's going to only continue. What are the tools that make that continue? What are they, and how do you buy them at scale in a time of austerity, so that you're ready when you didn't expect to not be in a conflict? Because we've been 100% right on not guessing when the next conflict's going to be or where. Now, and so we have to start thinking that way. The pressure of a budget reduction is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to use innovation, which is this country's strong suit, to help move us in a direction and get us out of very cost-imposing acquisition strategies and war strategies that we have been following, you know, out of necessity.
And you've made the argument that we really have to decide who we are and what we want to be. So, for example, maybe we no longer want to be in the business of being an occupation force in some Middle East country.
Right. I think one of the things that we have to have a more public debate about is we took a maneuver army and military that was built around a concept of maneuver warfare, offensive maneuver warfare into this conflict. We then made it into, people will disagree with me, but basically an occupation force. That the reason is we had enclaves that we came into at night where we were safe and we rested and refueled and replenished. We moved around in very heavily armored vehicles to protect our people to whatever it was we were going to. We got there, we did whatever we were going to do, and then we came back. That's an occupation force.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
And Afghanistan. The question is, do we want to lighten it back up, make it more expeditionary as we go to the future, more mobile, or do we want to stay with an occupation force, or do we want some mixture of the two? I'm inclined to lighten up, but what I'm more important in my mind is get the debate out there. Have the debate in the military schools, among the military people, have the debate in the think tanks and the analytic houses, and then bring it to the people so that they understand the choices that they have. We may not want to have that big, very heavy force. It may not suit what we believe is coming in the future. I mean, is it likely we're going to invade Russia or China with an army? I don't think so. You know, and so that puts the level of conflict and the level of violence at a very different scale than if you thought you were going to do something like that. Does that mean that we should have no defenses against those countries? Absolutely not. That's not what I'm saying. But what are the likely activities and what are the most dangerous activities and what is the error bar that measures between them and where do you want to fall?
Mm-hmm. Now, is there, because there are so many resources in the military, you know, in previous eras, say during the Cold War, that would ignite a hysteria about, you know, say for example, a rising power. At one time, the Soviet Union was considered, strangely enough, a rising power. When we look at China today, how do we navigate so we don't militarize our perception of the possibilities in China and the threat they pose?
I think that's really an important activity and something that needs to get better clarity. I worry that for maybe the wrong reasons we demonize somebody like China in order to justify investments that we think are necessary to be at least comfortable that we could defend ourselves if they continued on a path, or Russia, you can pick either one of them. But in doing so, we demonize them in order to justify the expenditures rather than turning around and looking at the activity and saying, what are all the elements of national power? What does soft power look like in this context? How do we create a relationship here that's appropriate? How do we have a reasonable balance of strategic stability so that our nuclear arsenal at the very high end and their nuclear arsenal and, say, Russia or any other country out there are constrained to a level that's appropriate and there's enough intrusiveness to have confidence that you're not being tricked? How do you get to that level? And it's not about building more fighter planes or ships. It's really more about how do you start a dialogue that has a basis in something other than military force? And how do you start to understand the values that you want to put in there? And then what are appropriate defenses and capabilities? And they will change with time. And so you have to have this is a process, not a solution. You have to be able to have this dialogue going on because as new technologies, missile defense, say, are introduced, the other side, if they weren't the introducers, have to have some way to make sure that they are not disadvantaged. Otherwise, you create instability. And you want to work your way through that, but it has to be a process. Sam Nunn is working this harder than anybody I know globally, and has for a long. You know, his work with Dick Lugar early on, but now in trying to understand how do you build in what technologies could we put in place globally to create decision time for leaders and tools that keep us from getting to the brink prematurely or for the wrong reasons.
One final question is, as we talk about the complexity of resource allocation, adoption of new technologies, new threats, looking into the future, how do we, as the public and citizens of a democracy, ensure that we in the future will be who we want to be, you know, committed to democratic values and all that has made us great. Because I think out there is the concern that the misallocation of resources could turn us into a kind of militarized state that we don't want to be. And I'm sure many people in the Pentagon don't want to be.
Yeah. You know, I think one thing that has endured for this country is the civilian control of the military. And it's not just the administration. It is the Congress, in addition, and the American people. I mean, most of our adversaries would tell us our center of gravity is the will of our people. That's you can get that to change. You can beat the United States. They will pull out or whatever. But that's also a strength for us. And so the likelihood that the military would move more into what many countries are today, the guarantor of sovereignty, versus being the one of the tools available to the country in a broad range of tools that are kept in perspective and balanced by the balances and checks and balances that are associated between the administration and the Congress. I think probably this is where Congress is probably the strongest and has been the best informed, the best most thoughtful about, okay, I understand where you're going. I understand why you think missile defense is important, but maybe there's really no threat there for missile defense, or maybe there really is and we need to go faster than where you're going. And have a voice and a powerful voice in those kinds of decisions and thoughts about strategy and the mixing of strategy and capabilities and how they're going to do it by owning the purse.
Well, on that note, General Cartwright, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be on our program.
It's been an honor.
And thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.